Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. This is the Fast Friday edition of the show for August 23rd, 2019. Now, if you've seen the film Minority Report, or if you've read the short story from Philip K. Dick that it's based on, you're familiar with the idea of pre-crime. This is the dystopian nightmare, this vision of government agents actually apprehending and stopping people before they actually commit a crime. So today I'm going to be covering a bill up for consideration in the Imperial Congress called the TAPS Act. And I also want to talk a little bit about something called predictive policing that's already being used in at least one major city today. Now, first of all, before getting to that, my name is Michael Bolden. We broadcast live every single Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time from here in my home office and studio in downtown Los Angeles for the 10th Amendment Center. A quick note, I will not have a live broadcast this next week, Monday, but we do have a pre-recorded interview with Mike Meharry that I think you guys are going to really like. If you want to find all of our archives, all the different platforms, video and podcast editions, all the ways to follow the show, to support us, go over to 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty, all spelled out. Now, since it's the Fast Friday edition of the show, I've got a lot to cover, and I normally like to get this done in about 10 to 15 minutes. I don't think I'm going to be able to pull it off, but let's see what we can do. First of all, this press release from January 31st of this year, 2019, from Representative Brian Babin, a federal representative from Texas. He introduced, along with Val Demings, the Threat Assessment, Prevention, and Safety Act of 2019. It's H.R. 838. And just that name in and of itself is pretty Orwellian. And in his press release, they say, the TAPS Act will provide our states and local communities with the resources, training, and support needed to stand up community-driven, multidisciplinary behavioral threat assessment units, allowing us to connect the dots and manage threats before an attack can occur. That's pre-crime. And it sounds pretty scary to me. Now, here's the bill itself at the website, congress.gov. It now has 126 co-sponsors, 126 co-sponsors, 63 Democrats, 63 Republicans. There's a companion bill in the Senate from good old Marco Rubio. You know, it can't be good. A lady named Kyrsten Sinema and Tom Tillis. Now, some people are saying that this is going to destroy half the Bill of Rights. That's how they put it over at Campaign for Liberty. The TAPS Act destroys virtually half of the Bill of Rights. It allows governments, they write, to government bureaucrats to spy on you without a warrant, take away your gun rights without your day in court, due process, or even you knowing about it. This is the 4th, the 2nd, the 5th, and 6th Amendments. And they go on to say, or at least you will not know about it until a SWAT team kicks in your door, shoots your dog, and stands on your throat at 3 a.m. It doesn't sound unrealistic, right? And they go on, they say, all of this will be based upon a bureaucrat's assessment that you somehow, in some manner, pose some threat to their big government schemes or could fit the profile of a one-day possible terrorist. This is what they're saying is going to happen with passage of the TAPS Act. Now, some people actually say, oh, man, you're nuts. There's no way. This is not what's going on with this bill. And, of course, over here at thetruthaboutguns.com, I believe it was a guy named Andrew, he says, do not assume that the TAPS Act tears up the Bill of Rights. It doesn't. He says, I pushed and pulled and stretched my interpretation of every sentence of the bill. I can't see any constitutional violations. I certainly don't see any 2nd, 4th, 5th, or 6th Amendment violations. They just aren't there. I have no idea where those criticisms are coming from. They are simply not based in reality. Now, I think on both ends of the spectrum, these are the two opposite ends, I think there is some truth and maybe a little misunderstanding or ignorance, something that's a little bit incorrect. So let's go to the text of the bill, because I've also read the bill. And the first few sections are declarations and definitions and things like that. The meat of the bill really starts coming in Section 4, Establishment of a Joint Behavioral Threat Assessment and Management Task Force. I think that sounds awful. That doesn't sound good. So the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security is going to create this task force. And what's key here is looking up in the definition section. What do they call? How do they define? How will the federal government define behavioral threat assessment and management should this pass? They'll be identifying individuals, this is from the text of the bill itself, who are exhibiting patterns of concerning behavior that indicate an interest, motive, intention, or capability of carrying out an act of violence. Man, that is really, really broad. So behavioral threat assessment is going to find people of an interest or motive or intention or even being capable of carrying out an act of violence. And once they do that, they determine whether or not that you need, quote, subsequent management of such a threat if necessary. So that sounds pretty broad to me. And should something like that get implemented, I would think that some bureaucrat, whether now or sometime in the future, is going to use that in a really, really nasty way. But unlike what C4L put, the TAPS Act actually doesn't implement this. What it's doing is it's creating a task force. And that's where the Truth About Guns report is actually correct. They're not actually implementing. They're creating a task force. The task force in and of itself is created within 120 days. And then in 180 days, it's terminated. So the task force, it's like a committee. If you've ever followed like state legislation, a lot of times a bill will get introduced and it'll actually do potentially do something really good. And what they do is they turn it into a study committee, a summer study committee. So then there's going to be a committee that studies the issue and issues a report on what they recommend should be done. A lot of times they take those recommendations and either follow up in a good or a bad way. They don't generally totally ignore them. So what this is doing is it's creating a task force that's based on so-called experts in this field who are going to recommend to the Department of Homeland Security what to do. They're required to come up with this report in 120 days, and then at 180 days, the task force is gone. It's dissolved. It says dissolution of task force. The task force shall terminate 180 days after the date of enactment of this act. And so some people, and I think that's the suggestion I got from the blogger at Truth About Guns, is that, look, it's innocuous. It's just going to be some reporting. And so Campaign for Liberty and others who are saying this is really dangerous are totally nuts. But I don't think they're totally nuts. It's just that I think they've made the mistake of suggesting that the TAPS Act in and of itself is going to do the implementation. That's where I think the error I found in a lot of reporting on this. But it's not innocuous either, because if you go back to the text of the bill again, in Section 6, the Secretary of DHS, quote, shall develop a national strategy relating to behavioral threat assessment and management and consider the recommendations made by the task force. Now, the word shall in a piece of legislation means required. Period. It always means required. The word shall is very intentional. So DHS is going to get recommendations. It's political cover by having these experts. They're going to say, we want you to do A, B, C, D. Maybe DHS will implement all of it, maybe some of it. And then DHS will be able to say, look, the leading experts in the country as chosen by Congress say this is the way forward. So we're definitely going to follow their advice, or maybe they'll only take part of it. The point is, Department of Homeland Security will then be required to implement something. We don't know what it will be. It could be something completely different than what's recommended. It could be something awful. I assume it will be. That's my predisposition on this, but they are required. And for those of you who don't believe me when I say that the word shall means required, the legislation reinforces that specifically in Section 6B, the very next subsection. The national strategy required under subsection A, which I just read, shall take effect 180 days after the enactment. So the process is TAPS Act, if it passes, gets signed. There's going to be this task force of so-called experts that are recommending behavioral assessment to deal with people look at this definition again, that have patterns of concerning behavior that indicate an interest, motive, intention, or capability of carrying out an act of violence. It is so broad, it's insane. So they're going to make recommendations on how to deal with this, create a national strategy on how to deal with this. And then the Department of Homeland Security is required to look at their recommendations and implement something. They don't have to follow those recommendations, but something will have to be implemented in under this type of a definition. So something is going to be implemented should this pass. It's just that it won't be implemented immediately. That's hopefully not too convoluted, but hopefully it makes some sense. So the short version is they'll do that. DHS will actually come up with a program, and then now the states will not be required. And they're very specific about saying that this is not going to be a national standard. The states can participate voluntarily. So they're going to use kind of like Common Core funding. They're going to use funding like a carrot and stick to encourage local and state law enforcement agencies, government agencies to participate in this type of predictive policing. Now, if you're not sure of it, predictive policing is already being used. I know it's all, of course, this type of profiling is already being used it's pretty well known that it's being used by the Secret Service, the SS, the U.S. Marshals Service, but it's also being used in conjunction with a federal funding program here in Los Angeles. It may already be happening in other major cities, but it's been happening here for quite a while. And early last year, in early 2018, the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, headed up by a good guy named Hamid Khan, got some documents released and did a press release explaining the whole big educational packet that a number of places reported on, explaining exactly what's going on with predictive policing here in Los Angeles. And I think going through this quickly will help you understand, hopefully, how they want to implement this type of thing everywhere. And so this report from theappeal.org, it's a great title. It says, How Pre-Crime Investigations Begin. They start out with target identification. This is how LAP does this. They look for probable offenders. They first survey police records. Then, in the second stage, they run it through a piece of software called Palantir, which takes a workup of the initial screening phase, and then it pairs it with social media posts. So they're scanning everyone's social media posts, data from license plate readers. So everywhere you're going, they're keeping track of where you go, what you say, who you're with. And then from that, it creates a, quote, chronic offender score for the individual, a chronic offender score. And once you have that score, and if it's high enough that they think it warrants attention for pre-crime prevention, then officers are, quote, encouraged to send letters and even knock on their doors to let those people know they're being monitored. Officers are also instructed to look out for opportunities to stop or arrest them if they have a warrant. Now, before they started using Palantir and made it all electronic, back in 2013, we have this example of what it basically was. Here's some guy, for those of you who are watching rather than just listening, you can actually see what this kind of threat score person had. They had this document, a dossier. This person had no warrant, was not on probation. They have their social security number, tattoos, what type of vehicle, name, date of birth. This person's on parole. Looks like they had possession of a firearm by a felon. Felony looks like it was a narcotics crime. So that's how they get you in the system. And then it's kind of a cycle. And then you go through this and maybe the guy's saying something on social media, he's mad or he's worked up about something. And so then that score goes up. And then through the license plate reader, he may drive to a high crime area. Maybe he's poor, maybe he's rich, maybe he's going to a business. But as soon as you go into that high crime area, maybe you're going to a Home Depot, I don't know. Then you get another score and they keep adding up these points. And once the points get a certain level, then you're considered a potential chronic offender. And that's when they start stalking you. They're encouraged to knock on your door to say you're being watched. Well, how do you get off of this? Kind of like the no-fly list or what the president at some point wanted, a no-fly, no-buy, right? You don't really get off of it. Well, at least in LAPD's version, which is funded in many ways by the federal government, the only way to get off of it is to not have an interaction with police for two full years. 2 full years. And now I don't know if the knock on the door or the send of the letter is considered an interaction with the police. But if it does, that means there's no way. This is like a catch-22, a circular thing. You'll never get out of it. But what they're doing is they're ramping up policing in these areas. They're basically following you. And I would think the odds of you not having any interaction with cops over a two-year period in a huge city when you're being stalked by police, followed, having them show up your door, they're watching you, the odds of that are probably almost nothing. But yet the LAPD Deputy Chief Dennis Cato says if they don't get stopped, they stop being on the list. The only way chronic offenders to get off the chronic offenders list is to not have any interactions with the police. This is according to The Intercept, a sort of catch-22, since the program is intended to flag individuals for increased police interaction. Now, the LAPD claims that these reports, these threat scores, these chronic offender scores are, quote, for informational purposes only and for officer safety. That's what they'll always say. But according to the documents that were obtained by Stop LAPD Spying Coalition from 2017, the report information is then fed to an internal LAP database, quote, for tracking and monitoring purposes. We know they are tracking and monitoring people. They're scoring people here in LA, not in every part of the city. We can be assured that this is only for the poor people or the people of color right now. That's primarily where it's being used in those communities. Not so much in my neighborhood, but right next door for sure. But they definitely want to use it everywhere. The documents say they want to expand this everywhere, 2019, 2020 or so. So this is an example of how pre-crime is actually being implemented. Predictive policing, behavioral threat assessment is happening through surveillance of your location, surveillance of your social media posts, following you, stalking you. And I think this is extremely, extremely problematic. And another system that they use here in LAPD is called PredPol, Predictive Policing, along with Operation Laser. This is sponsored by the Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance's Smart Policing Initiative. So this is a federal grant program. They're basically acting as federal agents. And if it's already a federal grant program, this should be a really good example of how the DHS is going to use the same type of approach in other cities around the country. And although they say it's not going to be a national standard, the likelihood of them doing this type of thing, I think, is pretty obvious. You know, in short, the short version, I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to really, really see how people might really abuse this at some point in the future. Now, that is, if you don't think the way LAPD is using it already, the fact that it exists is an abuse, if you don't think that's a problem, I do. I don't think this should happen at all in the first place. But even at its stage, you don't have to be too crazy or too out there to think how someone might ramp that up at some point later on. And if you don't have a problem with the DHS trying to implement a strategy to do this, not just in LAPD and not just in other big cities, but in every part of the country, every state in the country, you're really not a friend to the Constitution and liberty. Anyways, I hope you found this educational, interesting, enjoyable to watch. It's really, really important information. I hope you learned something. If you support what we're doing, please, 10thamendmentcenter.com/members, $2 a month does a lot. Do not feel obligated to pitch in financially if you're not able to, but if you can, I'm very grateful for that. If not, if you want to do some free things to help out, smash the like button, subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes. That all those things really, really tell the platforms that you watch or listen on to show the program to more people. Again, a reminder, I will not have a live show on Monday morning, but I will have a pre-recorded interview that Mike Meharry did that I think with Jose Nino that I think is really, really good. So please stay tuned for that. And I'll be back for the regular schedule next week, Wednesday and Friday. Again, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. I really appreciate it. Have an awesome weekend, and we'll see you here next week on The Path to Liberty.